You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, May 16th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Wonderful program for you today, ladies and gentlemen. Digby from the blog Hullabaloo will be joining us to discuss the, I guess it's the debt, but it's more like the debt debate. There's no real, there's no debt. Oh, gosh. Sorry, is it only Monday? Why am I feeling this way? Today, the debt ceiling has been reached. There will be extraordinary measures to maintain the, well, not the solvency, because we don't really, we don't become insolvent, but to make sure that we don't default on any of our obligations, except, of course, those from federal employees. We can default on their obligations because they're teat suckers. Come on. We will have more as the show progresses. A couple of programming notes. I will be on the Dilligan. The Dylan Radigan program this afternoon. You can tune in to MSNBC to see me on there. I imagine we'll be talking about the debt, but I don't know. I don't know for sure. And I also, you should know from a programming standpoint, I'm happy as a clam because of the Red Sox sweep this week. I was very surprised. People on Twitter didn't realize I was a Red Sox fan. I mean,
did that lose or gain you followers when they found out?
Well, people appreciate it. The Yankees are the evil empire. And it's nice to watch them fall apart like the way they're falling apart. Whether they lost like 8 out of the last 10 or something. Jorge Posada, unhappy. There's dissent. Derek Jeter, he's like walking around the infield with a walker at this point. He's lost about 4 or 5 steps. Be that as it may, ladies and gentlemen, a lot of news this week, this weekend. I was sort of stunned by the serious attention paid to Mike Huckabee's announcement. I thought it was already a foregone conclusion that this guy wasn't going to run. And apparently people actually tuned into his program Saturday night. I would imagine it's the highest rated version of his program probably in the history of the program. And I'm not just speaking about the past. I'm speaking about the future history of his program. And I didn't see this in real time. I don't know when, but apparently as soon as Huckabee's show ended, they had a pre-recorded news break from Donald Trump. I mean, this has become so just bizarre over there in Fox land that it's almost impossible to sort of wrap your head around it. Let's play this clip. This is the news break after Mike Huckabee announced that he wasn't going to run at the end of his program after playing a song with Ted Nugent. I'm not lying. Jesus. Play this.
I'm Donald Trump, and this is a special announcement.
Mike Huckabee is not going to be running for president. This might be considered by some people, not necessarily me, bad news, because he is a terrific guy. And frankly, I think it'd be a terrific president. But a lot of people are very happy that he will not be running, especially other candidates. So, Mike, enjoy the show. Your ratings are terrific. You're making a lot of money. You're building a beautiful house in Florida. Good luck.
What is this?
I don't have the ability to process this. You know, I refer to these people as these potential running these president. This is just a joke. It's just an extraordinary joke. And if it wasn't so enabling for the Democrats to betray working people in this country, the fact that the Republican Party has moved in from beyond an ideology into just sort of la-la land. I mean, Donald Trump, I really don't know what to say here. It's a piece in nationaljournal.com. Huckabee's pop culture plunge. Mike Huckabee announced he was not running for president in 2012 at the tail end of his program, or his Fox News show, I guess. Is it really a news show? Shortly after a jam session pairing the Baptist preacher and former Arkansas governor with aging heavy metal rocker Ted Nugent. The song, Nugent's ambiguously raunchy hit, Cat Scratch Fever. After the post-Nugent commercial break, and perhaps the strangest and starkest pivot in presidential politics, Huckabee explained the soul-searching that led to his decision. He said he had asked supporters to pray for him and identified himself as a follower of Jesus Christ. For me, the decision is ultimately not a political one, a financial one, or even a practical one. It's a spiritual one. I worship at the altar of money. Not for financial reasons. My $3 million house in Florida, that's inconsequential. It is that I pray to money. And I have been infused with the spirit of dollar bills. You look at my bloated body now, even after my staple job. And you can see that the spirit of dollar bills, yo, has infused me and actually made me look more husky. While many politicians use money and celebrity to gain power, Huckabee appears to be reversing the equation, using his political clout as a means to fame, riches, and the bestseller list. Running as president would have meant giving up a lucrative speaking gigs, a Fox News gig worth $500,000 a year through 2012. Last year, he broke ground on a beachfront home in Florida costing $3 million. I don't even agree with this dichotomy that the reporter has set up. Is there a Republican candidate in the field right now who's not doing this? Sarah Palin, I don't know if she's in or out. Donald Trump, I don't know if she's in or out. But Newt Gingrich, is there any doubt that Newt Gingrich's political campaign is the literal equivalent to a QVC program? Or what about any of these other morons on that stage? I mean, I think, yes, Ron Paul, I think he does it for ideological reasons. Tim Pawlenty thinks he might have a shot. But, I mean, is there any member of the Republican presidential field that is not at least one-third invested in just making some cash off this? How many, I mean, look across the country. Chris Christie, if he manages to get reelected, which at this point looks highly dubious. Scott Walker, highly dubious. He may not even serve out his whole term. Rick Scott, I guess he doesn't need much money. He's stolen so much from the U.S. government. I'm speaking as if in a figurative sense. He gave it all back in the form of a fine, except for a certain amount that he probably didn't. And meanwhile, as another fading star of the right continues his trajectory into the wormhole from which he came, Glenn Beck announced on his radio show Monday that he's planning to hold a rally in Jerusalem in August called Restoring Courage. Beck's Restoring Honor rally drew hundreds of thousands in Washington. I was there. It wasn't hundreds of thousands. It was maybe 100,000. Maybe. And where is the words nut jobs in Washington, D.C. in August of 2010? God is involved in man's affairs, but so is the force of darkness, Beck continued on his program last week. I believe I've been asked to stand in Jerusalem, I guess presumably by God, or maybe just somebody who wanted to see what happens when a guy like that stands in 120-degree heat. Many in the history of man have had the opportunity to stand with the Jewish people, and they have failed. I don't know what he's talking about here. He asked his listeners to stand with me in Jerusalem in August. I wonder at what point he starts actually providing the transportation. It's like a Rex trailer tour, if anybody knows what I'm talking about. Beck candidly admitted that he didn't know how many people would show up or even how much the event would cost, but he called the rally a life-altering event and warned that the very gates of hell would fight his attempts to hold the rally. I don't know. I mean, and meanwhile, on the supposed serious side of things, I'm at a loss, folks. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. Let's play this clip of John Bonner crying, just because I'm trying to gather my composure here. John Bonner went to Catholic University commencement. Remember that about 70 Catholic professors from these Catholic universities wrote and said, you know, you are ungodly, ungodlike, un-Catholic-like in your quest to destroy any type of, it's not even a safety net for the poor, it's a safety net for the entire middle class. Two-thirds of seniors rely on Social Security, things like Medicare, to stay out of poverty. And here he is. We're going to put this clip on the majority.fm page because you have to see how violently his face is choking up. Not his entire face is choking up because this is such a huge honor for him, or whatever it is for him. That's why he's crying. And here he is starting his speech crying. This is number two. Let's play this clip. You can first hear the announcer talking about it, the clapping for him. And this is the president announcing him. And Bonner is just weeping, blowing his nose. Here he is. I don't even know what that means. I guess he's saying that if you are all willing to sell your soul to the tobacco industry, then you can all become Speaker of the House someday, as long as you weep about anything that deals with yourself. And it doesn't hurt to take a shot at 11 o'clock in the morning so you can loosen up for your speech.
All you need are his tears to succeed. So he's going to bottle them and sell them to you, I'm sure.
There you go. That's actually the way you're going to have them sprinkled upon you in Jerusalem when you head there for the Glenn Beck rally. When we come back, I'm going to talk to Digby about the debt ceiling. And, you know, she had a post up. Head over to Digby and post this. It's a 9-minute video. So head over to Digby's blog and post this on the site. It's a 9-minute video. We can't play it all, but I think it's an incredibly important video. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. The blogger Digby from the blog Digby's Blog at blogspot.com. Welcome to the program, Digby.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I saw this. You had a post. I guess it was from Christian Amanpour's This Week Roundtable. It has Roger Altman, Sheila Blair, Douglas Holtz Aiken, I guess, and then of course Paul Krugman, and just tell me about this. This in the context of the debt ceiling being raised. We've hit the debt ceiling, I guess, today. One of the measures that they're using to, I guess, foreclose, excuse the pun, the default on debts is to borrow from the retirement funds for federal workers. Now, technically speaking, they're supposed to pay this back, but this may be on the table. But let's talk about that in a minute. But tell me about this roundtable that you highlighted here.
Well, they had the four economists on to talk about the debt ceiling, or I guess, I don't know if Sheila Bear's an economist, but she's the head of the FDIC. And it was, I mean, this was a sky is falling Chicken Little routine like I've never seen. Now, Krugman was the one dissenter, as he often is, but the three of them were just going on and on about how horrible this is, and the world is going to come to an end, and we're facing Armageddon. We must do anything we can to stop this horrible eventuality from happening. And what that did was set up this idea that, you know, this was actually a real problem, and it was almost as if it was an act of God rather than an act of you know, political intent. And Krugman argued with this at the roundtable and said, well, no, it's the Republicans are doing this. They're holding the nation hostage by insisting, you know, this used to be a normal thing to do. You just automatically raise the debt ceiling. One would never consider not raising the debt ceiling. Because defaulting would be, you know, you're right, it would be a terrible thing, and we want to avoid that at all costs, and nobody's, you know, seriously considering it. And what this brought up for me was the fact that, and I've been saying this for months now, since I first started hearing it, John Boehner, right after the election last fall, Eric Cantor in January, Paul Ryan more recently, all three have said the debt ceiling must be raised, it will be raised, but we're going to use this as leverage against the president. Now, to me, once somebody says that, they've lost their leverage. I mean, it's clear that they're not going to actually allow default. They're not going to do it. And of course they're not going to do it because Wall Street's not going to allow them to do it. And God knows these people, they may not be responsive to anybody else, but Wall Street is one group that they do listen to. This is not going to happen.
And this goes, there's a couple of Blue Dog Democrats in the Senate who have said the same thing, and it goes for them as well. I mean, I remember when Rand Paul was asked shortly after his election, are you really going to vote against the debt ceiling? Well, won't that destroy the economy? He goes, well, I'm going to vote against it, but it's still going to get raised. I mean, this is just preening on my part. And... I mean, I don't think he said it was preening, but he might as well have. But what really strikes me is that this clip, I mean, obviously this clip is just representative, but this is really the pinnacle of the problem, isn't it? I mean, this is really it's not even, all right, look, political parties, posture and this and that, but it's the fact that you have these so-called serious journalists down on one of these Sunday shows where they spend theoretically 6 days preparing for this thing, and pretend as if this is all real.
Exactly. I mean, we've seen a lot of kabuki over the years, you and I. We know that this is a big part of the way that politics are done in Washington. I've got to tell you, this is the most obvious one I've ever seen. I've never seen anything like this. When you have people coming out and admitting, like Rand Paul, saying, well, of course we're going to raise the debt ceiling, but, you know, we're just going to jack up the Democrats as much as possible. We're going to get everything we can from them, and then we're going to do it, of course. I mean, we're not that stupid. When you have somebody saying that, you know, blatantly to the press, and then we're going to, you know, we're carrying on now. Oh, my God, the sky is falling. You've got, you know, economists and Wall Street mavens like Roger Altman and you know, people like Sheila Bair, who's, you know, big shot bureaucrat in the government, all pretending like this is real. I don't even know what to make of that, other than that clearly, I mean, this is what you get to the bottom line here. Anything that happens as a result of this, quote, negotiation is something that was not forced to happen. Nobody had to do it. Clearly, the end game is already out there. They've already said that they're going to vote for it. So anything that happens here is something that they didn't need to do, they wanted to.
Well, let's get even more explicit, because, you know, John Walker over at Fire Dog Lake pointed out a quote by Mitch McConnell via David Weigel. And he's talking about the year after the bipartisan agreement between Reagan and O'Neill to raise the retirement age of Social Security. And he says, I do not exaggerate when I say I was not asked about it a single solitary time, not once during the course of the whole race. And the reason was that they did it together. When you do something together, the result is not usable in an election. I think there's an understanding if there's a grand bargain, none of it will be usable in next year's election. So when we see this kabuki theater, the real kabuki here is coming, on some respects, from the administration. I mean, isn't it? Because, like, clearly they have all the leverage because they know that nobody's really going to try and default on the debt. And so this is an active choice on their part to do something, to either because they want to enact these cuts, or they want to take it off the table, or some combination of both here. And so, and I think, you know, we've talked about this many times in the past, you know, to a certain extent, the idea that the Obama administration has a fundamentally different agenda than maybe some of these people in the Republican Party, that ship has sort of sailed on some level. But What is really sort of stunning to me is the it's almost impossible to find anybody in the media to call them out on this.
Well, even the most obvious point here, which is nobody will say, what do you say to the fact that John Boehner is on record saying he will raise the debt ceiling? Was he lying then? I mean, you know, nobody ever brings that up. Nobody ever says anything about that. And it's as if a sort of fog has, you know, come over, the political class, and they're just deep into their illusion here. The fact is that yes, there has to be a reason that the administration and the Democrats in Congress are going along with this. And, you know, you have to assume that they want the outcome here. which is an agreement, right? Now, there are a couple of ways this...
Whether that's a political motivation behind that or, a policy motivation behind that.
Yeah, I honestly don't know, and I assume it's probably as things usually are in those situations, some combination of the two. But if they're doing it, I mean, if they're doing it because they think that this is going to be off the table, then they really have they're very, very, very naive. And these things are never off the table. Case in point, they just made an agreement last December to extend the unemployment insurance through the end of the year, so that would be off the table. We wouldn't be arguing about that every 3 months. You recall we had to extend the Bush tax cuts partially in exchange for that particular deal. In the House right now, they're talking about reneging on that deal and, you know, changing the whole unemployment structure and basically going back on it. Nothing is off the table. And it never has been. I mean, as long as I've been observing politics, anytime you think you're taking an issue off the table, you're kidding yourself. The Republicans are going to use whatever they have against the Democrats. It's just how they play it. They play hardball politics, and that's a ridiculous assumption. So I can't imagine that these Democratic strategists don't know that. I'm assuming that it's more of a policy issue, preference than anything else.
Do you think they're also, I mean, I think to the extent that there's a political benefit to them here, it seems to me by drawing this out, the longer this can eat up time, I mean, they're going to get to the same resolution that they would have, it seems to me, 6 weeks ago. But if they can draw this out to August, they've chewed up a lot of time and are waiting till they get to, really the heart of the beginning of the campaign season.
I guess so, although I don't know how this benefits them because, the 2012 budget battle is going to be the truly huge one. That's the one where they're going to be voting on, you know, the Ryan plan and all that other stuff. So, and that's the one probably where entitlements are going to come onto the table. I haven't heard that they're on the table in this particular, you know, round of negotiations for how much government to cut. So what I did hear this morning is that one of the things that they've put on the table, and I don't know if this is true. This is just a report in the Wall Street Journal. That, you know, there's some stuff like some agribusiness subsidies and telecom something and some waste, fraud, and abuse. But they're going to put the federal employees' pension plan on the chopping block.
Right.
And so it's kind of a bit of a mirror to the Wisconsin battle that they're talking about agreeing to force the federal employees to pay more for their pension plan. And so, you know, I don't know that drawing it out to that end is going to be, it's going to actually help them. The minute they jump up, the minute that one's done, another one begins, in other words. And I think that's going to probably be the truly big one. This one we know. Everybody knows what the outcome's going to be. I think that the big budget battle, I don't think people actually do know what the outcome of that one's going to be. So that one is, you know, maybe they want to delay that as long as possible, but I don't see how that really helps them. But, you know, it could be.
I mean, the only thing I can imagine is that they think that there's some value in dragging the Medicare battle into more explicitly into the election. I mean, you have that that special election in New York 26 that's happening in 2 weeks, I guess, and that is – you know, one of those classic elections that really means nothing, but everybody's going to use as some type of benchmark for a couple months so they have something to talk about.
Right. It's going to be the bellwether for the alleged bellwether for the 2012 election. Well, you could be right. And if so, you know, perhaps that's a good thing. Now, what the administration is saying is that, in fact, Gene Sperling's quoted in the Wall Street Journal saying that they want to get this done immediately. So I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, they may be waiting to drag it all the way out till August. But, you know, at the end of the day, all the Sturm und Drang about this particular negotiation is nonsense. and any breath we waste on the idea that, oh my God, we're going to default, and you know the markets are going to quake, and you know everything is, you know, the world is coming to an end. If the Republicans don't get everything they want, that's nonsense. And you know the idea that this is never even brought up in any of the discussions is somewhat astonishing.
Well, why do you think that happens on in terms of a media level? I mean, I understand why they create this drama, because you create this drama because it theoretically it is the easiest thing to think of that might create some ratings for you. But I don't understand why this doesn't even enter into the fray. I mean, they mention the fact that like 4 out of 5 Americans want the debt decreased. As a poll, of course, they don't mention the follow-up, which is at the same time, 70 to 75% of them don't want Social Security, Medicare cut, and they want defense spending cut, and they want taxes raised. But why don't we ever hear this? I mean, is this simply, is it just laziness? Is there some notion of, this just still confounds me. You know, I'm beginning to think that the most important thing that can happen in politics at this point is a new infusion of producers on these television programs, because it's just a question of it just seems to me to be some measure of laziness.
Well, I think so. I honestly think that there is a comprehension problem on this particular one for reasons I just don't understand. This is, you know, I'm not even a poker player, but you know I can see what's happening here. This doesn't seem like it's particularly complicated to me. I did hear Ron Brownstein say the other day on MSNBC, he says, well, you know, John Boehner has said two completely different things. You know,
right.
We absolutely won't raise the debt ceiling, and yes, we absolutely will. And that's as far as it's gotten of anybody making note of the fact that this is actually, you know, a gain. And I'm not even, you know, I mean, do the players know this? This is something that's kind of curious to me when they go, you know, Biden's having these talks at Blair House or whatever. I mean, are they all sitting around going, well, what a joke, you know, okay, throw what you want on the table, I'll throw what I want on the table. I mean, they must know that this is nonsense. I mean, they must know that this is a joke. But are they pretending to each other, to their faces? I don't know how that works. I've never been in a negotiation where people had announced ahead of time
that they've already given up the ghost. I don't know. You know, the whole thing. The whole thing reminds me of development season in Hollywood, where people take meetings just because they know that they have to take meetings. So we need to burn a little bit of time and just make it look like we're doing a job. And one wonders, do they go home and say to their spouses, boy, I really managed to make it look like I was working today.
Well, I've been in some of those Hollywood meetings, and that's exactly what happened. So, they may be following that pattern. It's I don't know. I don't get it. I mean, this one really has me a little bit flummoxed. The budget battle, or the you know government shutdown battle that we just went through, all that had some kind of surreal but real kind of quality to it, where I got that there was actually the potential that the consequence that was on the table could happen. This one, you know, it's just not.
Strange.
It's not going to happen. So it's, you know, it's a very strange thing. And unfortunately, you know, one of the things that Krugman says in his column today, and I think it's important to note, that, you know, the more that the administration allows this sort of negotiation to happen, the more it's going to happen.
Right.
When the stakes are actually high, they're setting a precedent. And I wrote in a piece yesterday, I think this would be a perfect time for Obama to, you know, to bring out his Bin Laden playbook and, you know, be a big hero here. Just say no. I mean, just stare him down, say absolutely not, I will not do it, no way. I think people would cheer him. I mean, you know, this would be his, you know, the equivalent of his gutsy Bin Laden move would be to just say no on this one.
Digby, thank you for joining us. I am quite confident, if I am confident of anything, that moment won't be happening. but I appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it. We got to take a break. Digby from the blog Hullabaloo at digbysblog.blogspot.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Sam. Thanks.
We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk a little more about this. Also, an interesting revelation from WikiLeaks in Canada Things in Japan not going so good, and apparently a Gallatin overlord thinks that he can have his way with maids, but we don't know. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. We are back. Digby mentioned Paul Krugman's article, America Held Hostage. I recommend it, but it's, you know, it's the same. It's what we've been saying. It's all BS. Call their bluff. But the question is, who's the they in this instance? Because it seems like both sides are bluffing about the same thing. Meanwhile, Geithner has already suspended a program that helps state and local governments manage their finances and will begin to borrow from retirement funds for federal workers. According to David Weigel, Lori Montgomery in the Washington Post, Republicans have proposed saving more than $120 billion over the next decade by requiring civilian workforce to contribute more towards retirement. So what they're doing here is they're borrowing from the retirement program, and then part of the deal will be we don't have to pay it back. And we will screw federal workers again. Remember, they're already on a pay freeze, and when you put that against inflation, non-core inflation, just the two things that federal employees need to do, eat and drive, probably, they're already dealing with a pay cut, and now this so-called pension reduction imposes another pay cut on them by another 5%. There's no reason why federal workers should be doing even moderately well if we can manage to make the rest of the workforce not do moderately well. In other words, this is a race to the bottom. And it's almost like a tug of war. They gave me when you play, you know, when they get married at a Jewish wedding and they're up on the chairs and they hold the handkerchief and they're sort of like spinning back and forth. You just use the, you pull the federal workers down and then you can use that to pull the private and down. And everybody's just going down and down and down. To the tune of Hava Nagila. That's basically what we're looking at, ladies and gentlemen. Meanwhile, the head of the IMF, who is also apparently the premier candidate in the upcoming French elections, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, was arrested yesterday in New York, taken off an airplane, apparently facing sexual assault charges. Was to be arraigned this morning, attempted rape, criminal sexual assault, and unlawful imprisonment of a maid in a New York City hotel where he's staying. You know, I don't know what to make of this. The guy apparently has a history of, I don't want to say it, I mean, I guess attacking women. I, you know, reportedly, I should say, allegedly has a history of this. Key moment came, police said, when Strauss-Kahn called the hotel and to ask if he had left his cell phone there. A hotel security official fibbed and said he did have the phone, then asked for Strauss-Kahn's location to meet him and return it. Police made the arrest at New York's JFK airport, where Strauss-Kahn had boarded a flight for France. He is the fund's managing director. He's been a proponent of financial rescues in Europe as the global economy recovers from financial downturn and the continent reels from a series of government debt crises. In the great scheme of things, this guy is considered a little bit more to the left than your classic neoliberal IMF folks. He was going to be the leading socialist party candidate in France. I guess Nouriel Roubini implied that maybe there's a setup here. It could be, I don't know. I'm not going to pretend to even fully understand where Strauss-Kahn was in this. The number two official at the fund, First Deputy Managing Director John Lipsky, has stepped into the role of Acting Managing Director. My sense is this guy is sort of a bankster, but I don't know. I just don't know. But in the end, I'm just not a go-to person for this. I just don't know enough about it. But I can tell you what I'm reading, and there is some sense that the IMF has been to the left of just about every other major financial institution in the world at this point. That doesn't mean that they're on the left. It just means that they're the left because you got every other financial institution in the world talking about massive austerity. And it seems to me the IMF, I guess they got that out of their system in the 90s. More on that as I read things. But again, one of those blind spots for me. It's something I have not been following that carefully. I know that there has been a sense that there is a slight liberalization, and not neoliberalization, over at the IMF, but it's also coming at a very difficult time when you have Greece, again, on the verge of default. Apparently, austerity didn't necessarily have all the effects it wanted to. Meanwhile, residents of Kawamachi and Iatamura, both in Fukushima Prefecture, began evacuating Sunday to avoid high-level radiation from the Fukushima No. 1 nuclear power plant. Apparently, TEPCO has said that there are rods that are just uncovered from by water. These zones were designated as potential evacuation zones last month on Sunday. Farewell ceremonies were held in both municipalities. I think they're just basically rolling up these cities, saying there's a good chance nobody can come back here ever. We'll do our best to provide the same environment at your new homes as here, where people can raise children and grow old without anxiety, Mayor Michio Furukawa said. In Aitamura, about 4,500 residents will move from village to accommodations in Fukushima City, such as housing for local government officials and hot spring hotels. Households with pregnant women, babies, and small children are scheduled to evacuate first. Additionally, Social Security trustees came out with their updated projections. The date in which Social Security Trust Fund is to run out moved up a year to 2036. And the shortfall for Medicare jumped significantly from 2029 to 2024. Now, part of this was a function of past estimates of economic growth that had been revised downward. And part of it pointed out by Dean Baker, and I'm not fully sure I understand the implications of this, but that for some reason the Social Security trustees assumed an increase in life expectancy that was significantly greater than in the past, and also assumed that life expectancy would increase more in the near term than it would in the long term, which seems counterintuitive, and nobody can quite explain why. The report is far more optimistic about life expectancy than last year's report. It projects that men who turned age 65 in 2010 can expect to live another 18.6 years compared with the 18.1 figure projected in last year's report. I'm not clear where that comes from. Why over the past 12 months there would be a jump in essentially a half a year increase in life expectancy. Life expectancy for women at age 65 were projected at 20.7 years in the 2011 report, compared with 20.4 in the 2010 report. Again, remember, life expectancy is only relevant when we talk about these programs for those people who already reached the age of 65. The general notion of life expectancy is not relevant. Baker writes, this assumed increase in life expectancy is the largest factor in a projected deterioration of the program's finances. By having more improvement in life expectancy now and less in later years, because they revise their life expectancy in terms of the rate in which it will grow in future years, the near-term finances of both Social Security and Medicare look somewhere worse. Dean Baker also wanted to include the caveat that it has often been asserted that the government is borrowing to pay the interest or the principal on the bonds held by Social Security. In fact, the money owed to Social Security is already part of the government's debt, as can be seen by the debate over raising the current $14.3 trillion debt ceiling. That figure includes more than $2.6 trillion in bonds held by the Social Security Trust Fund. So in other words, it's all been included in the debt that we owe. Oh, we're over time. Let's. You can IM me at Majority FM. When we come back, the WikiLeaks revelation that Canada's politicians have the same capacity to lie to the people as the American ones.
Surprise, surprise.
Folks, if you can become a member, we seriously need you to. Today marks, well, I guess tomorrow does, our 7-month anniversary. Can you believe it, ladies and gentlemen? 7 months.
That's since hard launch, right?
Since hard launch. And we are 10 or 15 memberships down in terms of our projections of where we need to be. And I suspect it's going to be even tougher as we go forward. So our audience is growing, but our members, ladies and gentlemen, we need you to become members so that we can continue this program. Continue it and improve it. So please, if you are not a member, please. Can't afford to join, please do. And at the very least, I hope you're buying stuff through the Amazon link and buying coffee from justcoffee.coop. Those supplement your memberships, but they don't replace them. Stick around. You can IM me at Majority FM, or you can call 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this.